the full story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. It's Friday. That means it's time for our weekly news highlights. In our studio is WSHU's senior political reporter, Ebong Udoma. On the line, we have Sue Haig, the Hartford reporter for the Associated Press. Ebong, let's start with you. This weekend, the Trump administration is set to move forward with ICE operations targeting migrant families in cities around the country. This morning, Governor Ned Lamont held a news conference in Bridgeport to talk about the potential ICE raids. You were there. Tell us what happened.
Well, Connecticut is, there's no Connecticut city among the 10 major U.S. cities that have been selected for these raids. However, the state officials feel that they have to try and get the word out and take some preemptive steps to inform the immigrant community. And it was like a show of unity, all the Connecticut elected officials showing that they are against the ICE raids. And here's how Lamont summed it up.
We are a welcoming city here in Bridgeport, and we are a welcoming state. And that's what makes America a shining city on a hill. And we're not going to let anybody in Washington compromise that. And a lot of the words you hear out of Washington, maybe pass by, but a lot of them are dog whistles. You know, to me, it started out when you-know-who started challenging the birth certificate of the President of the United States, Barack Obama. And that was a signal. That was a signal that you are not like us. You are not really one of us. Really? Citizenship, as Susan would say. You know, what's the matter with finding out who's a citizen? What it deters and discourages and scares people afraid to participate in a census when they hear that.
And basically, he mentioned Susan, and that's Susan Bicewicz, the lieutenant governor. And she has a specific message for immigrants who are concerned. And this is what Susan Bicewicz had to say.
Governor Lamont and I want families who are concerned in Connecticut to know that if you have a concern about an ICE raid, we encourage you to utilize Connecticut's Family Preparedness Plan, which contains resources to ensure that children are safe and cared for in the event of detainment or deportation. And you can visit ct.gov Family Preparedness.
So that's the website where you can go and get information. And basically, the main thing that they say is that immigrants shouldn't volunteer any information unless they have a lawyer.
Now, is the Lamont administration communicating with ICE at all, with the federal government on this?
Talking about the federal government, U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal was also there. And he's introduced legislation in the Senate. He says he has 13 co-sponsors on this, which would prevent these types of raids. And he says it would make it illegal for them to have these types of sweeps across the country, and that would prohibit arrests in churches, schools, doctors' offices, courthouses. So it was... as far as also at the event was State Attorney General William Tong, and he's been suing the federal government over these things, and he says they've won every single lawsuit that has been decided, including the citizenship question issue, because Connecticut was one of the states, including Connecticut and New York, were both states that sued the Trump administration over there.
So this morning was a picture of unity, politicians, political leaders, but there's been some concern about the Lamont administration. There were some big staff changes that were made. Some say there's a bit of unraveling that's going on in the Lamont administration. Others say, hey, this is what happens. You find the people that work, the people that don't work, you make the changes.
Well, you know, for someone who had no state political, history of political office in Connecticut until becoming governor, I think Lamont is doing fairly well. He's still trying to figure out what's going on at the Capitol, and it seems he's trying to make himself a little bit more comfortable by he's trying to redecorate his office and spend his own money to make himself feel a little bit more comfortable. He had a rough time, though. And even though he pushes the fact that he got, he keeps talking about the fact that he got a budget passed on time, one of the signature policies that he was pushing was tolls, highway tolls, and he hasn't been able to convince the legislature to go along with that.
Well, he changed his position from what he was saying as a campaigner versus what he said as governor.
Well, he's hoping that these changes will help him have a better relationship with lawmakers. So he's brought in a former lawmaker, Jonathan Harris, to be his policy and communications director. Harris has a history of a long history with the legislature. He's also been a commissioner in the past. He's also led the Democratic Party in the state. So he's hoping that making those changes will help him deal better with lawmakers. And he's also been having, he's going around the state signing legislation that had bipartisan support, so he'd have both Republicans and Democrats in the same room. So we'll see how that goes.
All right, let's bring in Sue Hake at this point. She's got an interesting story. She wrote an article about a project that a group of Yale students are working on to get more women's profiles on Wikipedia. Sue, welcome to the program today. Tell us about this project.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it was something that I hadn't really heard much about, but after I went down to Yale, I found out that this is something that's happening all over the world, really, and especially in the United States, to try to get more women on Wikipedia. Roughly 18% of the 1.6 million biographies that are posted on the English version of Wikipedia are about women, and that's about 300,000 of the 1.6 million. In the last few years, there's been this real push to hold these hackathons or edit-a-thons, they call them, and people get together and they start putting together Wikipedia pages for notable women, especially in this case, notable women that are connected with Yale, to make sure they get this representation. I was down there. They had like a list of about 300 women that they had started off with, and it included a research scientist who worked at NASA, a chronic disease epidemiologist, some, you know, big people that you would think would probably have a page on Wikipedia. And the people that showed up, there were about 60 or so that came that day, and they got to learn the ins and outs of how you put together a page. You have to do a certain number of edits first. How do you do that? And that was a whole other part of the whole issue. It's not just that there aren't a lot of women who are represented in the biographies, but there aren't a lot of women that are editors on Wikipedia. And that's something that the Wikipedia Foundation wants to change as well.
That's because, for people who aren't familiar with Wikipedia and how those pages are created, this is user-generated content. So it's not Wikipedia's fault per se. It's just more men create pages on Wikipedia.
Right, and it tends to be more Western men from, you know, the West, from Great Britain, places like that. But yeah, it's a crowdsourced online encyclopedia, and it's one of the most popular websites in the world. And it's one of the first places that everybody tends to go to find out about people. And a lot of times, a lot of these women, I understand, may not be included on Wikipedia because there haven't been articles written about them. They haven't appeared in journals. And that's one of the things that their Wikipedia may be taking a look at. But that one of their rules is you have to have things cited about a person, and that's been one of the problems. I was talking to a professor that
a historical sociologist who's written about how women academics, they call them like the lost women, they weren't included in a lot of academic papers over the years. And so that has made it difficult for them to be referred to in Wikipedia. It was a fascinating, fun story to work on.
I bet. Let's shift gears quickly, and we'll probably continue this into the next block. But you've been following this long struggle over the Walk Bridge in Norwalk.
Yeah.
It's been many years. The federal judge ruled on this. Tell us what happened.
There had been a challenge to the Walk Bridge. If people don't remember, this is a 120-something-year-old movable bridge along the nation's busiest rail corridor down in Norwalk. And people probably remember that it tends to get stuck and create a terrible traffic snarl. So the State Department of Transportation wants to spend about $1 billion to include a new 240-foot vertical lift bridge over the Norwalk River. And there was a group that called Norwalk Harbor Keeper. It was a conservation group that sued the state and federal transportation officials, and they said there were cheaper and less environmentally disruptive alternatives. And a federal judge this week ruled that the plaintiffs, they lacked standing to sue. And he also determined that the government had made its decision properly after considering numerous different options.
Okay, Sue, you're going to stay with us. Yvonne, you as well. We're going to continue talking about this news stories of the week. We'll take a break first. This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. And we continue our weekly news highlights with WSHU's Ibang Udoma and Sue Haig with the Associated Press. Ibang and Sue, you both worked on two different sides of the same story. And this was a bill Governor Lamont signed that provides workers' compensation benefits to police officers and firefighters who've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Sue, tell us a little bit more about the bill.
Oh, this is an issue that has been going on for a long time. It really came up after Sandy Hook, and there were concerns that police officers who saw horrible things like that tragedy, and also the police officer who was involved in the chimpanzee attack, and if I remember that, that they were not getting post-traumatic stress disorder was not considered a coverage that would be something that could be covered under workers' comp. What happened finally this year is that the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, which is the largest organization of cities and towns in Connecticut, they reached an agreement with the unionized firemen and unionized police officers to come up with a plan that would provide workers' comp benefits but only for up to 52 weeks, because the cities and towns were concerned that they would be stuck with the cost of somebody paying them out, cutting them checks for the rest of their lives. Mm. So this was this solution was reached. But what happened was there was a lot of anger because not everybody was part of the final agreement, and among those are paramedics and medics around ambulance workers around the state who say they see a lot of horrible things too. They suffer from PTSD. They should have the same coverage. And I wrote a story about how some of these paramedics are trying to form their own organization and possibly hire a lobbyist. At least at some point they might do that, but they want to make sure that they have a seat at the table. They feel like they were left out, and they don't want to have that happen again.
Ibang, is this a cost-driven issue that they were excluded from this?
Absolutely, because you have to remember that the municipalities are concerned about cost, and you have volunteer first responders as well. And so they say they're going to come back and deal with this next session. It sounds great. I mean, everyone seemed all for it at the ceremony the other day, but it's where you're going to get the money from, and that's the conundrum that they have to deal with. You know, where is this? If you promise these things, where are you going to get the money to pay? And so we'll see how it goes. I mean, it's been 7 years since Sandy Hook, and it took that long to get here. So I don't know how long it will take to expand it to include the paramedics.
But it sounds, Sue, like paramedics, EMS, they're not going to back down. They're working on petitions. They're mobilizing. They're not going to let this go easily, are they?
No. I mean, they even if they don't have their official organization up and ready, there's like a core group of them that will be up here at the Capitol. I should mention, too, that the legislation that Governor Lamont signed, it does create a task force or a working group that will be looking at the issue. So maybe some of those cost concerns will come up. But there seemed to be also an awful lot of support among lawmakers. So many of them have family members that may work for the local volunteer fire department and have gone out on calls as a medic, or that, you know, this would apply to both paid and volunteer. So there's still quite a bit of momentum. And like I said, this group of medics who did create a petition an online petition during the session, but it wasn't enough to change the bill at the last minute. They're not backing down.
All right, I'd like to talk about a new tax in Connecticut, Sue. This one, the 10-cent plastic bag tax that's going into effect. When is this going to start?
August 1st, so get ready for it. it's going to last from August 1st to June 30th of 2021. And then after that, retailers are going to be prohibited from providing or selling single-use checkout bags to customers when they come in. So it was described to me as a sea change. It really is going to be a big difference for people when they go to the grocery store. You're going to have to probably bring your own bags, or you're going to have to buy recyclable bags. And the Food Association actually told me they're a little bit concerned about this, because even though this law doesn't take effect until August 1st, the lawmakers gave them a little bit extra time. They're a little bit concerned that they won't be able to meet the anticipated demand for reusable bags once the law takes effect. They were hoping to get maybe another 30 days to get a supply of them. I've been in Massachusetts, where I went to a Stop and Shop there, and they had these thicker bags that you can use over and over again. And those come from China. So I guess it takes some time to get them to the United States. Because this tax is going to be applied to bags that have a thickness of less than 0.004 of an inch. So it's those thicker bags are controversial too. But that's another story.
So it's a dime for every bag.
Yep, every one of them. And so I guess that would add up.
Well, some municipalities though already have the plastic ban in place.
Does.
Norwalk, Westport. Yeah. So in some communities, it's not going to be as big a deal. But I can see the faces of some checking out, and they've got a little extra they're going to pay just because they didn't bring reusable bags with them.
I know that they had a ceremony at Stu Leonard's the other day to
say goodbye.
To say goodbye to the plastic bags.
And this is in all stores, not just grocery stores. I mean, this is when you go to Home Depot or any other stores that use plastic bags. It's across the board?
Yes. It's all retailers would be prohibited from using these.
And does the state...
They would have to tax, and then they'd eventually be prohibited from using them.
And does the state expect in this transition period to have this... is this going to be a moneymaker for the state, or is this just to disincentivize people?
They have it budgeted. They're expecting it would generate $27.7 million in the current fiscal year and $26.8 million in the second fiscal year, beginning July 1, 2020.
All right,
it drops down a little bit because I guess they figure less people will be bringing their own bags to the store.
All right, those dimes add up. Okay, Sue Haig, thank you so much for joining us today, Yvonne. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Becky.
All right. In the studio with me now is WSHU Davis Donovan. He's been covering three bills signed this week by Governor Lamont that benefit the LGBTQ community. Davis, welcome.
Thanks.
Tell me about each of these bills. Let's start with the first one, the big one, the gay transgender defense bill.
Right. So the so-called gay panic bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that name comes out of most people are probably familiar with Matthew Shepard. From Wyoming, the Laramie Project covered his murder in 1998. You might remember an incredibly tragic case. Shepard was beaten and tortured and murdered, and it was a really important case, a really major moment in LGBT history. A lawyer for one of the perpetrators said that his client was driven. This was the defense he offered, was driven to temporary insanity because Shepard made advances on him. That's what the lawyer said. It didn't work. The perpetrator got a life sentence. But this defense has become known as the gay panic defense. In other words, the idea was that the perpetrator was so panicked by the presence of an LGBT person that they were driven to temporary insanity and committed. It's been fairly universally described as an odious and despicable legal defense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been banned in several other states. Connecticut is not the first state to ban this defense. California, Rhode Island, Illinois were the first. This year, this same session, Hawaii, Nevada, and also New York, most recently, also have passed laws now banning this defense. Senate President Martin Looney said there have been reports that the gay panic defense has been used in Connecticut. I couldn't find specific cases, but there's really no reason to doubt it. Research shows that it's been used in about half of all states.
Hmm. So this is going to be a big change. And the governor really has embraced the LGBTQ community in terms of going forward with new legislation in their support.
Right. I mean, if you look at the signing ceremony he had this week, there was a huge representation from the LGBT community. You saw people who'd been pushing for some of these three bills. And well, to talk about one of the other big ones is the creation of a health and human services network that's going to bring together a lot of disparate groups within the LGBT community in Connecticut. It's in terms of the bottom line, it's a $250,000 appropriation. But what it does is it creates this network that LGBTQ advocates say is really needed to have a safer and healthier environment for LGBT people in the state. What this means to real people on the ground is, if you're LGBTQ, you're looking for health services, you might run into a lot of, even in Connecticut, you might run into a lot of problems. I spoke to the director of the Connecticut Transgender Alliance who said she's heard reports of trans people turned away at the doctor. And there's risks to LGBT youth as well. Patrick Dunn, who's with the New Haven Pride Center, says, the homelessness rate for LGBTQ youth in Connecticut is higher than the national average. It's actually up to close to 30%. Here's what Dunn had to say testifying at a hearing earlier this year.
We here at the center, we do see a lot of youth coming through our doors. We offer free clothing. It's meant to be for individuals who are looking for gender-affirming clothing, but it's free to anybody in the community who might need a jacket, might need socks, might need any type of clothing. And we get an astounding number of youth that come through. New Haven is one of the hubs of homeless youth in Connecticut, and we definitely see our share of those youth coming through our doors and have tremendous relationships with organizations throughout the city to get them resources, find them housing, find them food.
So you saw at the ceremony this week, Patrick Dunn was one of the people who stood beside the governor. You saw Representative Jeff Curry, who's really been the driving force for these bills, one of the state's two openly LGBTQ lawmakers. And a lot of people that will be part of this network were standing alongside the governor. So they're very pleased with this legislation.
I think many are surprised that there's this kind of bias in a state like Connecticut, which is a blue state. It's surprising that they've had to take these steps.
Well, I think there's I don't think it's nobody's, you know, saying that this is a reaction to what's happening nationally, but you can look at what's happened. A lot of LGBTQ people feel under threat from what's been seen in some of the federal legislation or some of the federal decisions in the past couple of years. The Trump administration's moves to block transgender people from serving in the military. You've seen cases that could be perceived as condoning a bias or a prejudice against LGBTQ people from the business community, from in health in healthcare. You could see, you could perceived prejudice against LGBT people trying to find healthcare nationally. Connecticut's always really legislatively been on the forefront. We were one of the first states to have to legalize gay marriage, one of the first states to include LGBTQ people in hate crimes. Legislation, conversion therapy is banned here. Imprisoned people are housed consistent to their gender identity. So if you look at the laws, sure, you know, always been on the forefront. But as you said, you know, these things are still happening in Connecticut. Mm. Laws don't necessarily change people.
Now, there's one more bill that we didn't talk about. Right. And this one seems to me like it might be the most controversial because it involves minors.
Right. Yeah. And there was some testimony against this one at the state level. So it's called the PrEP bill. And PrEP is a pill. And it stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And here's the idea. I think you have to know what the pill is to really understand the bill. But if you take this pill once a day and it's about 90% effective, it can prevent or really, really lower your risk of getting HIV if you're exposed to HIV. So the new law basically allows minors to get PrEP, to get this pill, without parental permission. That's been very controversial. We've also heard a lot of stories from minors saying, you know, my parents would not have let me do this, and they're sexually active, and they could run the risk of contracting HIV. What parents testified, there was some opposition to this. You know, one parent testified that it takes away parents' rights to make medical decisions for their children.
Mm-hmm.
This, a lot of advocates credit this to one doctor from New Haven. Her name is Kristen Wagner, and she spoke at the bill signing ceremony and kind of gave her perspective as to why this was necessary.
At the heart of this bill being signed today by Governor Lamont are the needs of LGBTQ teens who are unable or not yet ready to come forward to their parents or guardians and disclose their status. This bill is one very important step towards allowing them to be empowered to protect their sexual health.
So, you know, advocates are very happy, obviously, at these three bills. You saw a lot of the community at the signing, like I said, and I think there will be more protections in the future. We don't know what those are going to be yet, but eventually that Health and Human Services Network, they're going to come back with some recommendations. You know, one of the things that they said that they were going to do was look for what they call pools of need, right? So places that needed where things need to be improved, and you know, I don't know what that's going to be, but I'm guessing we're going to see some areas where lawmakers are going to want to continue to improve.
So would this, maybe it hasn't been figured out yet, but would this Health and Human Services Network be part of broader human services networks, or will they operate independently of those?
Right. Well, they're reporting to the Department of Public Health.
Okay.
They are contained with, and they're reporting directly to the state. But within that, there's many, many different smaller groups. The New Haven Pride Center is one. The Trans Advocacy Coalition is one that I mentioned earlier. A lot of these groups are going to be working together, but ultimately what they're going to come back with is our reports to the state identifying areas where you know, we need better public health for LGBTQ people, and I think especially LGBTQ youth.
And was funding of these bills and any one of them, particularly the Health and Human Services Network and the medication without parental consent, was funding ever a concern? Was that up for debate? Was that back and forth on that?
Well, I think funding is always a concern, right? $250,000 is the big the biggest price tag on these. So you know, I think anybody you might have some people, and I think there were some people who said, you know, why do we need to put money toward this? But this was, there was a lot of bipartisan support for these.
All right. That was WSHU's Davis Donovan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a report that shows Long Island has the worst drinking water in New York and what's being done to change that. Stay with us. This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran. This has been a big week in New York for water quality. The state's health department announced it would adopt very strict standards for three toxic chemicals. WSHU's Desiree DiOrio is part of a team of journalists at Stony Brook University working on a series investigating the water quality on Long Island. She joins us now. Welcome, Desiree.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about your series.
So what we're looking at is the role that the Pine Barrens plays in regards to water quality. The way the pine, for people who aren't familiar, in Suffolk County, Long Island, we have this massive forest called the Pine Barrens, and it sits right on top of Long Island's largest source of drinking water, which are our aquifers. The Long Island Pine Barrens are one of the largest undeveloped surface areas that exist out here on Long Island. And when rainfall hits the Pine Barrens, it seeps into our aquifers relatively clean. It doesn't get contaminated with chemicals. And that's what we're looking at in our piece.
All right. So this has been a true source of very clean drinking water, has it not, in this particular area as opposed to other parts of the island where you see, for example, the Bethpage plume?
Yeah, what the Pine Barrens do is they sort of act like a filter for the water to seep down into the aquifers. Long Island has a long industrial history, and that has led to contamination in our drinking water supplies. You have the plumes, the Bethpage plume. You have other contaminants in the water in East Quogue, and all of that is a result of the industrialization that we've had on Long Island. So what New York did this week is propose the lowest levels in the nation so far for how much of these harmful contaminants should be allowed to be present in the water. And this has been a big topic here on Long Island after a recent New York Public Interest Research Group report that said Long Island has extremely high levels of 1,4-dioxane, PFOA, PFAS. So it's been a major concern. We actually had all four of our Long Island Congress members write to the administrator of the EPA last month begging for strict water drinking standards and begging for help for to help Long Island's drinking water.
But because this group of chemicals falls under these forever chemicals, ones that don't break down or can't be broken down over time, for New York, an environmentalist, these standards aren't really as good as they'd like and as strict as they'd like to see them be.
Right. Environmentalists are happy that New York is taking this step, especially in the absence of any sort of federal move in this regard. So the environmentalists are applauding this move in New York. But the environmentalists are saying, we already know that these contaminants are dangerous to people's health. So lowering the acceptable levels for drinking water is a great first step, but it has to be not the last step. It has to be a continuation.
You know, in your reporting for your series, what are you hearing from residents on Long Island that concern in terms of concerns about their drinking water and its impact on their health?
Residents are definitely concerned about what is coming out of their faucet when they turn it on. There have been some communities where the local governments have distributed bottled water. There have been other communities where, you know, people are worried about bathing, about drinking, and all sorts of water-related issues because of the contaminants that we know for a fact are in Long Island's drinking waters at very high levels.
How I know that this will not go into place, these new drinking standards, right away. I think there's a six-month public comment period. How long do you think it's going to take for the average Long Islander to feel comfortable with the drinking water in their community?
That's a really good question. What Governor Cuomo's move this week did was really set the regulatory process in motion. There is going to be a public comment period, but this is going, I think, going to go a long way towards making residents feel more comfortable about their drinking water.
And do you think the governor is going to be able to bring in some federal dollars for this? I know the EPA, we've talked about this on the program this week, about the EPA not regulating these chemicals and very difficult on the federal level. I think Governor Blumenthal from Connecticut is trying to get money for some of this cleanup. I mean, I think the cost has become a real concern, hasn't it?
Yeah, the costs are concerning, but what Governor Cuomo did was get money through his Water Infrastructure Improvement Act and other grants, other grant programs that he has. And it's also going to be help. It's not going to be, I don't believe it's going to be the state paying for it itself.
And overall, when you concluded your series, what was your takeaway regarding the overall health of the water system, the infrastructure, filtration, the system at large on Long Island?
The reporting is still ongoing. What we know so far is that environmentalists are trying to protect Long Island's Pine Barrens because it is this large, undeveloped space. And that undevelopment of that area is hugely, hugely important to keeping the water in the aquifers clean. That's going to be the subject of our first bit of reporting. And from there, we're going to look at the development that's being proposed right now in the Pine Barrens and how residents feel about that. It's been very interesting to learn where how the Long Island Pine Barrens play such a important role in keeping Long Island's drinking water clean.
All right, WSHU's Desiree DiOrio, thanks so much for joining us today on The Full Story.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
And we go from water to driver's licenses. A county clerk from Western New York is suing lawmakers over a new law allowing undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. For more on this, we turn to J.D. Allen, the news editor for WSHU. J.D., good to see you.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Describe this law for us. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So the law, as you said, it allows undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses in New York. And that process can be a little bit complicated. So in areas upstate, it's the responsibility of the county clerks to give out driver's licenses. On Long Island, it's the state DMV who takes that. It's really just a matter of jurisdiction and what different counties can afford to accommodate. So in Erie County, where the lawsuit comes from, they are saying that it violates their responsibility to federal policy and labor laws that prohibit employers from allowing illegal immigrants to work in the country.
So basically, let's go back because, all right, so this law is on the books now, but then just this week, there's a lawsuit that's been filed by this clerk in Erie,
mm-hmm.
Who's using immigration law, basically, as... labor law.
Part of it is that he is concerned, well, he's a Republican, this county clerk from Erie County, and he is concerned that He's using kind of Cuomo's own language, Governor Cuomo's language, of being concerned that federal immigration officials are going to be able to use this data collected to be able to find these undocumented immigrants. That's kind of part of what he's been talking about. The lawsuit itself kind of plays more on the federal labor policy issue. He says he's violating his responsibility to the U.S. government.
This has become a very big deal that the initial push or initial argument for giving undocumented immigrants driver's licenses was they can get to work. It allows them to participate in the economy.
Exactly. And in areas like Eastern Long Island, where you have a lot of undocumented workers who don't live on the Twin Forks and have to commute into the Twin Forks to do an array of different jobs, it can be a big deal whether or not they can have they can legally drive their own vehicle to get to work.
And now we see the 21st century spin on this with facial recognition.
Yeah, it plays into it a little bit. I mean, so the facial recognition component is that federal immigration officials would be able to use facial recognition to identify those that are photographed for their driver's licenses and be able to find where they are and deport them.
And compare other databases.
Exactly.
And this is going on. Other states who are ahead of New York in terms of granting driver's license to undocumented immigrants. State of Vermont, for example.
Yeah, New York is number 13. I mean, this is going around and this is going on in other states and has been a part of state law in other areas of our country. The concerns from a generally blue New York comes more from a lot of moderate Democrats and those across the aisle, the Republicans, who are kind of concerned about this from different perspectives. It's interesting to note that when this law was approved in the New York State Legislature, all six Long Island senators, all the New York State senators from Long Island, voted against this bill. And that was really upsetting to a lot of Long Islanders, undocumented people who live on Long Island, and people who just live in immigrant and minority communities on Long Island, because they helped campaign and get some of these people into office. And then they felt like they were betrayed when they didn't get the driver's license vote on their behalf. And that's really evident in, say, State Senator Monica Martinez's district. She had come from the Suffolk County Legislature in a predominantly minority community, and that's the group who ultimately got her elected to the state Senate. And now that she's on the state in the state Senate, those that had helped her get elected, her base feels betrayed, and social media is a really ugly place right now for Monica Martinez.
But the thinking, I mean, you would think that she would support the ability for undocumented immigrants to get to work or pay their bills, pay taxes, etc.
Yeah, the advocates are saying huge things are possible, like being able to get to work, that are now capable for this. Capable with this law. This law, they say, improves road safety, being able to produce a driver's license if you were to get into an accident is a key step for anybody who's trying to get insurance to be able to fix their vehicle or claim injury. And also the economics of areas like Eastern Long Island that rely on workers getting to and from those regions. Monica kind of sided more with Governor Cuomo, which was coming from the area of, well, what if ICE is going to be able to, you know, find my base, more or less?
Mm-hmm. And his concern, privacy restrictions to prevent ICE from coming in, stepping in, and then using this facial recognition technology.
In the final moments before this law was approved by the state legislature and before Cuomo put his pen to the page, he went to his attorney general, Letitia James. He went to a lot of the his law backing. The law side of this, mm-hmm. to ask, like, hey, are the feds going to be able to find undocumented immigrants? And Attorney General James had said it should be okay. You should go through with this, and she would defend anybody who says that this is going to become a problem. So ultimately, it's going to be James is going to be the one that's going to be fighting the Erie County Clerk on this issue. In a recent visit to Long Island, she had said that a law like this had existed in New York for decades before. A similar law that was established was abandoned in the wake of September 11th because of security concerns. So this is kind of replacing a law that had existed at one point, she said. We'll have to see what happens as it plays out in court.
In some states, it's a driver-only license that's issued. Yeah. Could this be used as an identification card as well? I know Connecticut, it's a driver-only card.
So while I'm not sure of the extent of what the card will allow them to do, because it's being put on hold. It was supposed to roll out, I believe, by October, but because of pending lawsuit, Cuomo has kind of put the brakes on it until this is figured out. But what a lot of people, especially in the GOP, are saying is that they're worried that something like this will inadvertently create a system that will allow non-citizens to sign up at the DMV to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, when you go to the DMV, you check off whether or not you're eligible to vote, and they're worried that somebody just kind of quickly filling out the document, trying to, you know, get on with their life at the DMV, is going to check the box. It's not going to be caught, and now there is an undocumented person on the voter roll. And this has already happened even before this law has been in place. On the assembly floor, one of the assemblymen from Long Island, Doug Smith, had produced a couple of forms that were from the Suffolk County Board of Elections that reported multiple cases of voting activity by non-citizens with DMV numbers. Mm. So they received these DMV numbers by going to the DMV and probably going through either a former iteration of this law or some kind of just identification card. And the only reason why the Board of Elections caught this was because many had to make formal requests to unregister themselves before they are allowed to apply to become citizens.
Ah, complicated.
So it makes it even more complicated.
In light of what you've said there, then, what's the likelihood that this lawsuit's going to be successful?
I think we're going to be reporting on this for quite a while. I think just about every branch of this conversation is going to come up with some kind of sticking point from Cuomo, from those that are on Long Island on either side of the aisle, to those upstate. And then you have New York City progressives that are kind of pushing everything along.
We'll be doing this interview again at some
point. I'm sure.
All right, J.D. Allen, the news editor at WSHU. Well, that's it for this week. I'm Rebecca Saran, and for Ron Ropiak. Everyone, have a great weekend. See you next week.